On the theme of amazing butterflies, I wanted to tell you a little bit about the research I've been doing for the past, probably 30 years or so. We're going to focus on the past 10 years mostly, but the idea is that, you know, we have amazing butterflies in what I'm going to call your backyard. And when I say your backyard, I'm not talking about the place where you pull dandelions. I'm talking about the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. So your backyard includes the greater Yellowstone ecosystem, and it has some amazing things happening, and you might not even happen to notice some of these things until you slow down and look around. So that's part of my message, is to slow down, look around, and there's a lot of stuff happening out there that can give us an indication about the state of our environment. So because I'm a professor, I have to ask a couple questions and get you, make sure that you're not asleep in the audience, right? So here's the first question. I'll ask for feedback. Okay, so when you think of a butterfly, what image comes to mind? Monarch. Really? Wow. Yeah. That's what I thought you were going to say. Did anybody think of anything else? Oh, right, a blue morpho. Cool. Okay, so yeah, thank you from the audience. But most people think about monarchs, right? Okay, here's the second question. When you think about where a butterfly goes in the winter, what comes to mind? Mexico. Ta-da. Okay, all the monarchs sitting on a tree in Mexico. Okay. Perfect. You got all the answers correct so far. When you think of butterfly habitat, what image comes to mind? Wow, you guys must have gotten the Cliff Notes or something. Yeah, okay. So we're not going to talk about that tonight. Most butterflies don't fit that description. The ones that live around here, for the most part, don't fit that description. Okay, so we do have monarchs, not very many of them. But everything that you've learned so well from the media about butterflies doesn't apply for the most part here, okay? They do have wings, but a lot of the things that you've learned about the natural history, I hope I'm going to tell you something new tonight. Okay, so here's one of the characters you're going to hear about today. This is Parnassus clodius, one of my favorite butterflies. My students have told me it looks like a very small polar bear with wings. I would agree. It's a little bit yellow, but if you look at them closely, they're very fuzzy. We also think that it has the best face of all the butterfly species that live around here. There are about 120 butterfly species in this area. This one has the most charismatic face, so that's why we're going to look at it a little bit today. And we're going to talk to this Parnassus clodius, and it's going to tell us a little story about the natural areas around us. So why do you think we should care about this? Why should we care about these little organisms out there? Well, if you've been reading the newspaper lately or listening to NPR, you might have heard that there's been a large loss of birds. And so one of the statistics that came out recently is that there's a net loss of about 3 billion birds. And that's since 1970, compared to the 1970 abundance. So that's a huge change. And so people get worried about that. They say, well, what does that mean? And that's a significant finding. If you've been reading further, you might have noticed that insects are also showing declines. Some of the numbers that have come out recently, and these are both papers that came out in 2019, showed that Germany, Germany had a 76% decrease in flying insects over the course of 27 years. Puerto Rico had between a 78 and 98% decrease in insects in 36 years, depending upon which kind of insect you're talking about. And some people might say, well, great, that means less mosquitoes, less gnats, you know, I don't need to worry about that. But if you've heard some of those proverbs about killing mosquitoes, there are some potentially negative ramifications. These two pieces of data might be correlated, right, because birds eat insects quite a bit. So when we think about one butterfly in your ecosystem and thinking about the population dynamics of that species, hopefully it's going to give you a little bit of information about what's happening to our insects in this ecosystem broadly, and that links to many other kinds of species. So why study butterflies? I have lots of reasons. I'll tell you what they are. First of all, it's a heck of a lot of fun. Gary Larson got it right. I mean, this is, you know, we are definitely having a good time out there. We have a net. Everybody gets their own net. We sing. We get along mostly. So butterflies, why do we study them? They're abundant. They respond quickly to environmental variation. They're relatively easily surveyed. You don't need a lot of money to do butterfly surveys. You do need a permit, by the way, though, if you're going to do this in the National Forest or in the National Park Service. They're relatively easily identified. So for those of my friends who study beetles and bees in the audience, they're easier. Yes, we know that. And that's a good thing for the most part for us. So butterflies can tell us a lot about the world. Here's a picture of one of our Parnassus butterflies, and you'll notice that this is not a normal marking. For those of you who are doing insect ID, we added that one. Okay, so that's not a character trait that you would actually use. So Parnassus butterflies overwinter right here. They require undisturbed meadow habitats, and they can serve as an indicator for climate change. And I'm going to tell you a little story about why that is the case, but they basically are in the form of an egg all winter. So right now, if you were out in their habitat, the eggs would be out there in the habitat waiting for spring to come when they would hatch into caterpillars. So recently I received a grant from the Disney Conservation Fund to help tell the story about Parnassus, and we're going to call this Wings That Make Waves, the Parnassus story. And you can see from this draft that this is chapter intro goes here, a short blurb, so we haven't written it yet. But basically, I'm working with a biological illustrator to put together an iBook that will be able to be used in K-12 school classrooms, and we're going to try to use this to tell the story about Parnassus. But I'm going to give you a little bit of an overview myself. So Parnassus occur in many parts of the globe. In Europe, we have Parnassus apollo, which looks like this. Not too different than this one, but if you look closely, there are some differences. This is a renowned Eurasian butterfly, and it's decreasing in several of the countries that it lives in. It's gone extinct in 3 countries, and the major threats in Europe include tree encroachment, toxic metals, believe it or not, and habitat loss. Parnassus, Clodius, and Smintheus, this is Clodius here, and they look very similar. They occur in the U.S. and in Canada. They're relatively well studied, and one of the major threats there is that tree encroachment is changing the habitat of the montane meadows that they live in. Here's Parnassus Smintheus. Here's Parnassus Clodius. The colors on the outside of the wings are depicting the ranges. Here's Parnassus apollo. This one's called Nemesine, Parnassus Nemesine. So people across the globe have been studying Parnassus for decades. And what we're trying to do is take that data and get an understanding of whether we can see cross-continental patterns in how these populations go up and down, and whether we can correlate those with environmental variation patterns. So let's step back for a minute and think about climate change. And if you had to ask yourself, well, how will a species respond to climate change? A really simple way to think about that might be to say, okay, we have this species that lives here. This is its range in that red blob. And if we thought about climate change, we could probably say, well, maybe that species is limited by some temperature in the winter. And well, this is just fictitious, but we'll say 0 degrees centigrade, it doesn't make it past that temperature. And maybe if warming happens, that line might move north, and we would hypothesize that that blob might also move north, right? So that's one of the simpler ways of thinking about climate change and how a species could respond to climate change. What I want to tell you is that it's not quite that simple. Here's another way to think about it, and this is a little cartoon that one of my colleagues drew about 20 years ago, so we could probably update that one in the next couple of years. But anyway, the bottom line is that there's a little blob here, and that's your habitat patch for your species of interest, and you can imagine that if things got warmer, that patch might move up, okay? And that's one of the hypotheses. The patch might be a patch of a certain kind of plant that a certain animal uses. But we can also imagine that if that patch was something that was related to where the rivers are. So if that was a sedge, if that was a patch of sedges and things got warmer, do you think the river's going to go uphill? No. So that patch might go away. So that patch might dry up and the sedges might go away. And so the plants and the animals associated with that might go away. We can make a little bit more of a complicated diagram about Parnassus, and this was done by some of my friends in Europe and Canada, but here's their image of their Parnassus apollo with its favorite little plant there, and this is the current time. And today they're saying, well, basically that plant's moving up a little bit, the butterfly's moving up a little bit, there's some shrubs that are kind of encroaching in there, And then in the next few years, we might imagine that things move up the hill a little bit more. And it might be possible that in the future, those plants can't live there anymore. And they're gone from the top of that mountain. And you see a little cross there. It was a bad day for that butterfly. So that's kind of one of the images of what could happen. So these are all kind of simplistic images of climate change and how species could respond. Some of this could probably be a good summary. And it does have the specific kind of plants. And when you lose those plants, you lose the butterfly. So here's some real data. And I'm going to show you some pictures of real people doing real science across the globe and show you how all these pieces are connected in this story about this one butterfly. So this guy is Jens Roland, and this is Nusha Kegaboldi, and these are some of their friends at a meeting in Finland about the biology of butterflies. But Jens wrote a paper with his, at the time, postdoc, Steve Matter, and they looked at how alpine meadows were changing. This is 1952. The white is meadows, the dark is trees, forested habitat. Here's 1993. So you can see what's happening to the meadows. Going down, right? So the trees are moving up the hill, the meadows are getting smaller, and they're correlating that with the population dynamics of their butterfly, Parnassia smintheus. Nusha, by the way, ended up doing a whole genetic analysis of this, which is I'm not going to talk about, but that's another piece of the story. And then they also looked at how the winter conditions affected the populations of this butterfly. And so there's something called PDO, or Pacific Decadal Oscillation. You might not have heard of that. You might have heard of El Nino. But PDO is another kind of synthetic measure of what the conditions are during the winter. And it has to do with warm temperatures in the Pacific Ocean and how that affects the climate, primarily on the West Coast. But they found out that the variability in winter climate related to this thing called PDO, which is related to climatic patterns, was a really good indicator of how the population of their butterfly, which would be in Alberta, would go up and down. Okay, so this is a paper that they published. Then on the other side of the world, my friends Mirek and Andrej, Mirek here, Andrej here, they have much longer names, and they're graduate student Katarina, I'll just use the first names for now, they've been studying Parnassius apollo, and this is their Parnassius apollo. I was able to go to a meeting in Poland about 10 years ago and meet these folks, and so we've been talking since then about the synthesis of data between these multiple countries. And so here's Katarina, and what they're doing there is they're actually doing captive rearing of the butterfly because the population got so low they were afraid it was going to go extinct. So they could grow the plants here. It's a sedum-related plant. They got the butterflies. They captured the butterflies. Butterflies lay their eggs here. And then one of the guys who kind of a retired taxidermist who works for the national park started rearing the butterflies. And this is his hand. And this is a butterfly with the wings that have not fully completely emerged to be full size. But what they did was they were able to captively rear these butterflies and then release them. And so they've actually done a pretty good job of increasing the population in this one population in Poland. So here's a picture of where the butterflies live. This is a very steep slope. This is the national park. It's called Pieniny if you're speaking English, Pieniński if you're in Poland. But it's called Three Crowns. See the three, almost three crowns, maybe four, but it looks a little bit like the Tetons if you squint, except that the trees go way up to the top, right? And the fact that the trees go way up to the top of these peaks is actually an issue for the butterflies. So on their website, this is the Polish website for their park, Pieniny National Park, they feature Parnassius apollo. They even have mugs. Pretty cool, huh? So what they've been studying is that, here's 1920, okay? You can see how many trees there are there. Here's 1995. The trees are just moving straight up the mountains. So basically, if you're a butterfly that likes a mountain meadow, this is a bad situation. If you're a beetle that likes to eat pine trees, it might be okay, right? So for their butterflies, the patches of habitat have gotten really small. Another place in Europe, in Finland, this is Marianne Fred, who is studying Parnassius apollo on these little islands in Finland. You can see these couple of islands over there. And the population there is also very low, and to the point that they're doing translocations among these little islands to try to keep it going. So that's kind of the story, the background story of this butterfly, kind of from a global perspective. So as we think about that, now we're going to go back to our local landscape and ask, how does that all relate to our local landscape? So here's a local landscape in the Tetons. And as you'll see, this is a meadow with a lot of sagebrush. It's got a particular kind of sagebrush. And it's got a lot of flowering plants in it. But if you look at the soil is really pretty poor. But this turns out to be a highly productive place for Parnassus clodius. And we've been doing mark recapture studies there. I just have to show you this picture because I've noted that over time that the best field technicians that we've been able to hire have previously served as lacrosse players on lacrosse teams. So if you know anybody who's a lacrosse player, let me know. It's pretty effective. So one of my first grad students she was my first grad student that worked on this project, Julia Auckland, started working on this in the late 90s. And basically, this is a paper that came out of that. And we were able to start doing this mark recapture where we would start capturing in this one meadow between 200 and 800 individual butterflies every year. We know that the males come out first and they're more numerous. The females are more secretive. But we were really impressed to be able to get a 15 to 25% capture rate. And ironically, the people who study grizzly bears work in the same area. And I won't tell you where this is, but they're really jealous about my recapture rate because they can't get numbers like that. So that means that we can estimate our population size pretty accurately. Okay, so here's what we do. We write on the butterfly wing with a Sharpie. We hold it with a special pair of forceps. We let it go, and they fly away. Okay, so nobody dies. Catch and release. So what we find over time, and this is just from 2009 to 2019, you'll see that the males are here. This is abundance here on the y-axis, time over on the x-axis. And the males and the females sort of have a mirrored pattern. The males are always a lot more numerous, but you can see that we caught, over 650 males in 2009. We got about 830 this year? 867 this year, okay, so that's a good year too. So, but the question is, what makes these populations go up and down? So one of the questions is, can we use the same kind of approach that the Canadians are doing with their data like PDO, Pacific Decadal Oscillation, and use that information to predict when the populations are going to go up and down? The other piece of the puzzle is we've looked for this. You might say, well, why did you just spend all your time in this one meadow? Why don't you look somewhere else? Well, we did. So these are all the other sites that we've looked. So the main meadow that we're talking about is over here. The places that are purple are where we found the butterfly. The places that are orange are where we looked for the butterfly but did not find it. So we went all over the Teton region looking for a Parnassus. And this is work that I did with my previous grad student, Kim Skodronsky. And you'll see that there are certain kind of patterns, but one of the interesting things is this brown stuff is all sagebrush. The green is sort of forested openings with meadows in them. So you can sort of see this cluster of a certain kind of habitat where there aren't as many butterflies, and then these green places that have openings that have more butterflies. One of the things we tried to figure out was, what was it about the habitat? So here's a sagebrush meadow, okay? And that's what some of these look like. But here's another sagebrush meadow, and this is a particular sagebrush called Artemisia arbuscula, which is relatively short. But it also has a lot of flowers in it. So we've been trying to figure out what the composition of plant community is that is needed to support this butterfly. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about what the natural history is now for a few minutes and just give you a little background on that. So we have in our story about Parnassus that we're going to do for the K-12 kids, we have a little snippet called Butterflies Are Picky Eaters. And we figured kids would like that, right? Because kids are picky eaters. Well, this butterfly, Parnassus clodius, is really picky. It only eats this one plant. Does anybody know the common name of that? Steer's head. Okay, cool. If you already know that plant and you know where it lives, come talk to me afterwards. But this is the only plant that the caterpillars will eat, period. It blooms about May 5th, and by June 15th, when the butterflies are flying, you can't even see this plant. It's completely dead. It's dried up. It's as if it was never there. So the butterfly is going to lay its eggs in a place where the plant is but it never sees the plant. So that's another interesting story. But the butterflies are correlated with the location and the abundance of the plant. So there's a lot of detective work in this kind of job. In terms of the nectar plant, so the butterflies are going after a different plant when they're adult, and they're going after things like Eriogonum umbellatum, which is sulfur flower buckwheat, and we also find that the butterflies are correlated with that plant. This is one of their favorite nectar sources. So one thing you might ask, and people even asked me at the beginning before we started talking, tell me about pollinator gardens. So for monarchs, which I know is in your brain, everybody's been trained very well to think about monarchs, right? They're creating these monarch way stations all across the Midwest. And the idea is that as the monarchs are flying through, there's a good place for them to get some nectar. And so it's easy to plant this stuff. Milkweed is a weed. Thank you. So it grows really well, right? So it's one thing to make a way station for a monarch. It's not that easy to make one for a Parnassus. So way stations are important for butterflies that are migratory, but they're also important for butterflies that are just happening to be in a certain area. So non-migratory butterflies, which is like 95% of them, also can use these resources if you get the right plants there. So they're good for non-migratory species, but they're not quite so easily constructed. We tried to grow some sulfur flower buckwheat this past year, and we had 17 plants on order, which was the maximum number we could get from a nursery that grew them. That was the only one that grew them. They all died in February or March when there was a kind of a cold wind and freezing event. So it's not quite so easily, it's not quite as easy to construct way stations. The Dicentra uniflora, the host plant that the caterpillar uses, Simone and I were talking to a guy who's been studying them for 10 years, and he said, whatever you do, don't let your PhD student work on this plant. You'll never finish, okay? So some plants are easier to work on than others. Weeds are good if you're working on weeds. So the best option for habitat protection and habitat creation is just keep the habitat that we have. So here's some of the habitat. This is us looking for caterpillars. This is Tori Ritter, who was volunteering on the project in the past. So here's us looking for caterpillars in probably mid-May in our field site. You can see that there are not that many flowers yet, but that's when the caterpillars are there. So another piece of natural history is that the Parnassus smintheus, this is the one my Canadian friends study, is a very showy-looking caterpillar. It's also toxic, as you can probably guess from the spots. It eats a plant called sedum. Okay, so my Canadian colleagues collect all this data on caterpillars, and they have really amazing data. We have this, which is really hard to find. We found like 5 caterpillars at the most in multiple years. So they're very secretive. They're not toxic. We know that already because we've done some chemical studies. And we think that they actually only come out at night to forage because they might, and my theory is that they're probably being attacked by ants. There was somebody in the audience who was talking about ants. Yeah, there's an ant story here that we don't know yet, I think. So that's our caterpillar. But you need to understand all these pieces when you ask you the question, why do these populations go up and down? Is it the eggs? Is it the caterpillars? Is it the butterflies? Okay, so here's an excellent cartoon that my daughter drew for me a couple of years ago when I had to tell this story. So here's our egg. Here's our butterfly egg. And remember that they have been laid in July. Here's our Tetons, or, you know, Gallatin range, if you want. And so our egg has its nightcap on. It's sleeping under the snow. That's what it's going to be doing pretty soon, okay? The snow forms like a down comforter for this butterfly, for the egg, that is. And so it sleeps happily. It's not having a bad day. But as spring comes, some of that snow melts. Thank you, Zoe. And this egg is not quite as happy. It's kind of cold. It lost its down comforter. And so the story behind all of this is that we think that the temperatures after snowmelt could be one of the really important indicators of population size, because we know that after the snow melts, if the temperatures go below, on the order of like 15 below zero Fahrenheit, and that's not that hard to imagine around here, right? That could kill the eggs. So one of the things we're doing to actually quantify that is a team of us dug a big hole, which was not very easy in this meadow, but we can tell you more about that some other time. But we put this thing in called a PhenoCam. And so this is a security camera with a solar panel hooked up to a battery in a bear-proof container. Okay? So far, so good. So this thing takes a picture, just as if it was taking a picture of your front driveway, but we're taking our picture of our study site. So here's a picture from April, late April one year. This was in 2018. And here's what happens as spring comes along. We get these melting conditions, as you can imagine, and we can take pictures all along through the season, and we get the phenology of what's happening in that meadow. But what we can do with that data is we can say how many days after the snow melted did the conditions get below a certain temperature, say maybe 15 below Fahrenheit. So that's what we're doing now, is actually using that PhenoCam to tell more about the conditions for those eggs in the early spring, because they have to make it through spring while the snow is there and then make it into the caterpillar stage. Okay, so that's kind of the observational part of the story. So in order to do good science, what else do? Besides observing things? We do experiments, right? NSF loves that, okay? So so we decided we couldn't just say, well, this is what we think is happening. We decided we need to do an experiment. So my student Jill Sherwood and some collaborators and I put this together in 2010. So we started doing an experiment using passive warming structures. That's what this thing is. It's got plexiglass on it. So there's no electricity. And we move snow. And in this landscape, we can move on the order of 2.5 to 3 feet in the late spring, which means late April to early May. And when you move the snow away, what you're doing is you're taking away about 50% of the moisture that goes to that landscape. It's perfectly flat. It has to be flat for this to work. But if you take the snow away, you can reduce the moisture to that part of that soil throughout the whole growing season. Okay, so here's what the experiment looks like. Control, nothing happened there, we just put flags in. Snow removal, we take the snow away, we leave a little bit over the vegetation so that we don't disturb the vegetation too much. We have passive warming, and then we have the combination of these two different treatments. It's kind of fun, but it can be a little bit hard on your back. Sometimes this is us as the day is getting to the end of the day and we're still digging. This is my colleague Matt Germino with his team from Idaho State. So here's what it looks like after we set up the experiment. So there are 12 plots. There are 3 replicates of each of 4 different treatments. Here's what it looks like in July. So we've got this data logger that has a cable that goes down into the ground, and it measures the soil moisture and the soil temperature. We have these things called hobos, which are not people. They're little kind of mechanistic blobs that you sit on the landscape, and they measure the light and the temperature of the soil. Then we spend a lot of time measuring plants, which is one of my daughter's favorite things to do, right, Zoe? So every 3 days we go out and we measure these plants. We have arrowleaf balsam root and we have sulfur flower buckwheat, and these are some of my crew several years ago. And what we're doing is we're looking at how these different treatments affect the growth rate of the plant, the time of flowering, the time of senescence when the flowers are done, and things like that. Because the question is, would a change like climate change allow the plants to actually bloom at the wrong time relative to the butterflies? So you have to think about the potential for asynchrony here. So here's a not too bad of a graph, hopefully, but this is about green up. And if you know about some of the perennial plants around here, just look at these leaves first. They go from red to green in the spring. Right now they're going from green to red. But perennial plants around in the alpine will often be red in the winter and then turn green. And so what we did for this sulfur flower buckwheat, Areogonum umbellatum, was we looked at what percentage of them were green up, versus time. So here's the 24th of May to the 9th of June, which is a pretty short amount of time. But if you look at these different treatments, here's the control. So it's happening latest in terms of greening up. Here is the heat only, a little bit faster. Here is the snow removal plot, quite a bit faster, and then here's snow removal plus heat. So basically, everything is being shifted up to an earlier time and a higher percentage of green, meaning that the heating and snow removal in combination did things the fastest. But snow removal generally had the biggest impact on how fast those plants would come out and start growing. Something that we didn't actually think about when we set this experiment up was that some flowers actually also respond to negative temperatures in the spring, and this is arrowleaf balsam root, and these are what we call aborted buds. They tried to create a flower, and things just didn't work out because there was probably a freeze. And so if you look at a meadow that has a whole bunch of arrowleaf balsam root in it, some years you'll just see a sea of yellow, and other years you won't, and it probably is related to what the conditions were and whether there was a freeze event. So we looked at the number of aborted buds, and here's the average number of aborted buds, which means that they didn't make it to flowering. The control and the snow removal had a pretty high number, but anything with heat, any kind of treatment with heat, basically had no aborted buds. So the heating treatment, which is just a passive warming thing, which elevates the temperature of the soil by a couple of degrees, made the difference between whether those plants had buds that died or buds that actually turned into flowers. So this relates to the climate change theme again, because if there are less freeze events, there could be more flowers for the pollinators. Continuing on the theme of arrowleaf balsam root, which is a plant that we're very fond of, we've been actually following some of these individuals for a long time, and some individuals we have data for about 10 years, and one of the students that's working in my lab is actually synthesizing this data, and this is looking at the effects of treatment on first flowering date. And this is Arden Engel working with Simone in my lab. This is Julian date, meaning the date from January 1st to later. So this is later timing in the summer. And these are the different treatments. And what you see is that the control has the highest Julian date for first flowering. As you go into heating, it's a little bit earlier. But anything with snow removal is basically giving you much earlier flowering. And I didn't show you on this graph, but there's also a lot of variation in the total number of flowers that these plants produce over years. So we're pulling that data together as well. Because the same plant might have very, very different number of flowers from one year to the next. Okay, so what else do flowers do? They give us something else. And you probably can't see what's happening here, but why do we care about flowers for pollinators, especially butterflies? What are we looking for? What do flowers have that butterflies want? Nectar. Thank you. Okay, excellent. You passed. Okay, so in this picture, which you can't really see very well, but right here is a little tiny capillary pipette. It's glass. And what we're doing is we're sticking that little tiny glass tube into that flower early in the morning when the mosquitoes are also trying to bite us, by the way. We have to do it very carefully. And so we could take that little drop of nectar out, and then we can put it into something called a refractometer, which is also not electrically powered. It's just powered by the sun, which is very cool. And so we can measure the concentration of sugar, and we can measure the volume of sugar and ask ourselves, how are these plants doing relative to the different treatments? And something that you might not have thought about unless you're taking an entomology class, which I know some of you are, maybe this should be a quiz, one of those, but bees and flies have certain kinds of mouth parts that are particularly associated with lapping nectar, okay? Butterflies, this is not the best picture, but because it should say capillary action instead of sucking, but they have this thing called a proboscis, which unrolls, and it's really like a straw, and that nectar goes up that straw-like appendage into the butterfly's mouth, okay? So why do we care about that? Well, here's an analogy. Suppose you went out to get a malted milk shake, and you went to your favorite place, but they made the milkshake really, really thick. And you went and you took your straw and you tried to sip that milkshake and you were really ready for that malted milkshake, but nothing came up because it was too thick. Okay? So the straw has to be the right size for the nectar to come up, and the nectar has to have a certain viscosity to be able to go up the straw. So the hypothesis is that there could be potentially some problematic issues if nectar gets too concentrated. So going back to that previous image, different insects prefer different concentrations of nectar. So we're actually measuring the concentration of nectar. And this is a close-up of that same flower. And so this data is only looking at heating, not snow removal. But when you looked at heating, we found that compared to the control, heated plots had more flowers, which is good for pollinators. But they actually, in some years, had more flowers that had no nectar, okay? So the proportion, the number of flowers with nectar went down in the heated conditions. The volume went up, and the concentration went up. And you'll see that there's some variation among years, so different conditions in the year's amount, you know, in terms of precipitation of rain, how wet it is, how hot it is, could affect these variables. But the take-home message is that heating could affect the concentration and volume and even presence of nectar. So if things change too much, it could be a problem for the insects. So stay tuned. Okay, so recently I received a grant from the Disney Conservation Fund with a colleague of mine from Iowa State who does biological illustration. Her name is Kim Moss, and these are some of her images. And so what we're trying to do is take the story of Parnassus and tell that story in museums, visitor centers in the national parks, and places like schools. So this is part of the book that we're putting together. And so just to show you some amazing pictures, Kim just put this together. So this is her rendition of A Parnassus. But we're hoping to make multiple renditions of this and actually maybe even make some kites that we could show, you know, in museums that would lure people into looking at iBooks that would tell them about the science and things like that. So getting back to this this storybook, here's the draft of this book, and it's going to have information about how you find the butterflies, you know, basically what they're doing in the wild, and a bunch of different natural history things. And at the end, we're going to have them ideally start looking for butterflies in their backyard, whether it's in this area or in other places. And the other thing that we're going to do in this is we're going to have a few little video clips. And so this summer, we spent some time working on little video clips with a couple of sentences, and some of you may recognize Ben Sisson, who is my field tech, and this is Simone Durney, my grad student. So let's see if this works. We have a little video to show you.
People often come to Grand Teton National Park to look at these larger animals, but they tend to overlook these smaller animals like Parnassus, which is a kind of microfauna.
Microfauna? What's that?
Micro means small.
And fauna means animal. Parnassus are small animals with a big story.
Awesome. Okay, so that's one of the little video clips. It probably took us like 2 hours to do that, literally, right? It's amazing how hard it is to say two sentences perfectly. We had so many good bloopers. We're going to have to watch those another day. Okay. The other thing we want to do with this book is bring the story about Poland and Europe and Parnassus Apollo to the kids as well. So here's my buddy, Andrzej, whose English is not that great, but it's a lot better than Mirek's English. And so bear with him. He's there at Pieniny National Park. These are the three crowns. And if you look carefully, you might see a butterfly go by.
Here we are in Pieniny Mountains, small calcareous range that is part of much bigger Carpathian Mountains range that forms an arc in Central Europe about 1,500 kilometers long. Pieniny, despite a small, are one among the most picturesque places in Poland. Behind us, you can see the highest peak in the Poland, called Three Crowns. Pieniny are covered mostly by forest habitats, but among them, there are patches of non-forest habitats, mainly meadows, alpine and subalpine meadows, and also high meadows like this one around us, and of course, this scree that is habitat of Parnassus Apollo butterfly.
Awesome, huh? Yeah. He's amazing. Yeah. So they sent me one of those t-shirts after they had their meeting. Okay. So the take-home message is, you know, pulling all these things together and thinking about the connections between all these places on the globe. There's a butterfly in your backyard, meaning the greater Yellowstone ecosystem, that can tell us a lot about what's happening in the larger ecological community. It does require these pristine montane meadows, and we can't easily create way stations or new habitat for it, so it means that we need to protect that habitat. We do think that warming and decreased snow could potentially affect the butterfly eggs. It could affect the nectar resources, and it could affect the synchrony of the timing when these butterflies fly versus when the plants are flowering. And then the other main point we want to leave you with is that there's always more to learn, so please stop, slow down, and watch the natural world around you. So when you drive through the Tetons next time, you might be looking for bears, or you might be looking for bison, but look for these butterflies as well. So that's kind of one of my take-home messages.